Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Anna, have you been enjoying your time in Fulton County divorce court? Do you live there now? Do you have a sleeping bag tucked into a corner of the courthouse?
I mean, I honestly think that the Cobb County Superior Court clerks would not be surprised if I moved in, but we're finally done, and I'm here to talk about it.
I'm so grateful you've been following this because I've been trying to avoid it as much as humanly possible, to be completely honest.
Yeah, it hasn't been fun, I've got to admit.
Why hasn't it been fun? I mean, it's so juicy.
Well, you know, Alan, when you sign up to report on the alleged, attempts of a former president to overturn Democratic election, and then you end up in a situation that feels more like the Real Housewives of Atlanta, then it's a little bit odd.
This is still sounding fun to me.
Tyler, are you volunteering? And you can go down to Atlanta anytime you want and relieve Anna.
Well, it would be a great homecoming. I could stay with my grandma, have matzo ball soup at night. Yeah, sign me up.
No, there's like a definitely an element of it that's very, you know, are you not entertained?
Anna, how about this? You can go to my grandma's house and she can make you matzo ball soup, and that will make everything better.
That'd be fantastic. Is your grandma, what's her matzo ball soup like when it compares to, you know, the matzo ball soups of other grandmothers?
Well, obviously it's the best in the world.
Don't ask a man to criticize his grandmother's matzo ball soup.
Tyler's grandmother listens to Rational Security and she would be upset.
Tyler's grandma saw me on TV once and it was honestly the best moment of my life when Tyler texted me and said, my grandma said you did a good job.
Well, I think you've earned
That's
your matzo
so
ball
sweet.
Soup. Seriously, we got to get Anna this soup next time she's in Atlanta.
I would say my object lesson is the recipe, but obviously that's a closely guarded family secret.
The real question is does your grandma use the mix or does she start with actual matzo?
Oh, I think like all good grandmas, she uses the mix, the Manischewitz mix.
Yeah, exactly. The Rosensteins are a proud Manischewitz mix people. Good.
Yeah, real Jews know.
Well, hello and welcome to Rational Security. I am Alan Rosenstein and I'm here with one of my regular co-hosts, Quinta Jurassic.
Hello, and guess who's not here?
Guess who's not here? Scott Anderson, who is currently on parental leave. Congratulations, Scott. His baby is extremely cute. Hopefully he's having a good time, and by good time, I mean waking up every 90 minutes, because as I myself discovered 4 months ago, life choices have consequences, even if they're very cute consequences. But have no fear, listener, we have a wonderful guests with us from the Lawfare Clubhouse. Managing editor Tyler McBrien is here.
Hello.
And legal fellow and Atlanta soap opera correspondent Anna Bauer is also joining us. Thanks, Anna.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on for the first segment. So we're going to call today in honor of Tyler's grandma, the Tyler's grandma's matzo ball soup edition. I'm really jealous. I really want to try it now. Can you bring some in for all of us one of these days, Tyler?
Definitely. I think actually, no, the better option is we all fly out to Atlanta to visit her and have it in person. That seems like the
party
most
at
practical.
Tyler's grandma's house. I love it. Well, we have some great topics in national security news to talk about today. Topic number one, Roe v. Wade, the long saga of the personal relationship between Fani Willis, the Fulton County District Attorney prosecuting Donald Trump for election interference, and Nathan Wade, the prosecutor Willis put in charge of the case, hit an inflection point last week when Judge Scott McAfee, who is overseeing the criminal case, ruled that, although there was no actual conflict of interest, the appearance of impropriety remains. He ordered Willis to either recuse herself from the case or remove Wade from his role as prosecutor. Wade promptly resigned, clearing the way for the case to continue. Is this the right resolution to the controversy? And what does it say about the future of the Fulton County case, especially if Trump appeals and tries to force Willis's disqualification? Topic 2, pleading the Fifth Circuit. In a sign that even the conservative justices may be losing patience with the Fifth Circuit, Missouri received a chilly reception in oral argument on Monday when it tried to defend a circuit opinion preventing the government from virtually any communication with social media companies about removing misinformation and harmful content. How is the Supreme Court likely to rule, and what should the rule be when it comes to concerns about government jawboning? And topic number 3, Cy Oops. Thank you, Tyler, for that one. That was really, really good. Reuters has reported that during the Trump administration, the CIA engaged in an influence operation on Chinese social media to spread negative information about Xi Jinping and other Chinese leaders. Was it effective? Was it a good idea? And what should U.S. intelligence priorities be with regard to China? For the first topic, I'm going to hand it over to me to talk about Nathan Wade's resignation. And as I like to do when we have an expert on the topic, I'm not going to do an intro. I'm just going to turn it right over to the expert. Anna, you're joining us for this first segment. So just set the stage for listeners who have not been tuned in to every twist and turn of this soap opera over the last several months. What is the conflict here? What is the issue? What did Judge McAfee say? And what's happening next?
Right. So this conflict arose back in January when right before the pretrial motion deadline for this case, it seemed for many months that everything was going very well for the prosecution. And then Ashley Merchant, who represents Mike Roman in the case, who is one of the co-defendants of Trump, who is accused of attempting to overturn the 2020 election, she filed this motion in which she argued that Fani Willis was engaged in a personal romantic relationship with her special prosecutor, Nathan Wade. And as a part of that relationship, it was alleged that she received, you know, luxurious vacations that were paid for by Wade, that he paid for dinners, that she received these kind of indirect financial benefits, and that as a result of those benefits, she received, you know, this kind of incentive to continue to prosecute the case against these individuals as long as possible. Nathan Wade, of course, you have to recall, is someone who's not a salaried employee. He is paid by the hour. And so as a result, you know, there was this argument that she was paying him and then as a result, getting this kind of kickback scheme. As a separate issue that arose related to this, about a week later, we're not totally separate, somewhat, you know, related to it, but a separate legal grounds arose for her disqualification about a week after this motion was filed. The prosecution had been quiet about everything. And then all of a sudden, Fani Willis goes to this historically black church on a Sunday and gives a speech. And during that speech, she kind of makes these veiled references to the defendants and to this motion that had been filed in which she, you know, said that they were, you know, had made these attacks as a kind of racially motivated strategy, defense strategy. At least that's what it seemed to imply. You know, her speech was very vague about who it was she was actually talking about. Was she just talking generally about critics who had, you know, come out against her in the wake of this motion being filed? All of that, you know, she didn't deny that she'd had a relationship with Wade and focused on his qualifications as a prosecutor instead. So that speech itself gave Trump some additional ammo, because he then filed a motion in which he adopted this motion to disqualify and then said, you know, in addition to this conflict of interest that was created by Fani Willis hiring her alleged boyfriend, she also made this speech that Trump argued was inflammatory and kind of was what's called forensic misconduct under Georgia law. That is a grounds for disqualification that refers to extrajudicial statements in which a district attorney, you know, makes comments about the accused that kind of implicates their guilt or innocence or taints the jury pool in some way through those public comments. So those were the two grounds that really set up this motion. It was there a conflict of interest related to the relationship with Wade? And was there forensic misconduct that would disqualify Fani Willis?
And so what did Judge McAfee, who was overseeing this case, what did he ultimately decide with respect to these issues last week?
Right. So Judge McAfee is very interesting because Judge McAfee ended up kind of splitting the baby in a sense. He said, you know, he reviewed the evidence that had been submitted after all of these motions were filed. There was an evidentiary hearing. There were witnesses. Ben and I wrote a piece in which we analyzed the evidence and actually kind of it was very similar to how McAfee ended up looking at the evidence. But he basically said, you know, I don't think that the evidence has shown that there was a conflict of interest. You know, even though there definitely was money that changed hands between the two, it didn't seem like, the defendants had met their burden of establishing that there was an actual material pecuniary gain or benefit that had been received by the district attorney as a result of the relationship. And then he also looked at, you know, at one point, all of this kind of shifted to this question of whether or not Fonnie Willis and Nathan Wade were being totally truthful about when their relationship started. Did it start before he was appointed as special prosecutor? Did it start afterward? He looked at that and said that although there were questions that remain about how candid they were in their testimony and throughout the process about the relationship, he still found that it did not amount to a finding that, you know, that basically the relationship did start before they said it did. So he ultimately held no actual conflict of interest that would require a mandatory disqualification of an elected district attorney under Georgia law. However, he did something very interesting in which he said, but looking at the way Georgia courts have talked about a different standard where you look at not just whether there's an actual conflict, but an appearance of impropriety. He looked at case law on that where Georgia courts have kind of referenced, you know, the need to get away from any kind of appearance of impropriety by a district attorney. And he said that if there is an appearance of impropriety, I can impose some sort of discretionary remedy that doesn't necessarily have to mean disqualification of the district attorney. And here he said, I do find that there is an appearance of impropriety. And as a result, he basically gave her an option. He said, either you can have Nathan Wade withdraw from the case to get rid or negate this appearance of impropriety, or you can withdraw your entire staff from the case and yourself and hand the case over to another district attorney's office or a special prosecutor who would be appointed by a nonpartisan state body. And of course, that's kind of a false choice, right? Because it basically means get rid of everyone, including Nathan Wade, or get rid of Nathan Wade. And so by, I think it was around 3 o'clock that afternoon, Nathan Wade had resigned, and they ended up filing, you know, that resignation correspondence. Additionally, there's the separate matter of the forensic misconduct issue that I mentioned, which relates to mainly the church speech. And that part of the opinion is interesting. He found that, you know, the church speech did not amount to forensic misconduct as it has been kind of described in Georgia case law, although he noted that there's not really a whole lot of descriptions of forensic misconduct in Georgia case law. He said it was pretty ambiguous who exactly it was that Fonnie Willis was talking about. Was she talking about the defendants or was she talking about, for example, the county commissioners who had kind of criticized her in the days after this motion was filed? He, you know, focused on those ambiguities within the speech because she never named the defendants and never said Trump or Mike Roman or whatever. And so for that reason, he found that she would not be disqualified on the basis of forensic misconduct as well. But he did say her comments were legally improper and that it may be the time for the defense to seek a gag order even of, you know, seeking to gag the prosecution from making any public statements in an extrajudicial context, which is very interesting. Something I've never seen a judge, you know, suggest. And really, you know, even though this was a victory for Fani Willis, it seems like those are the types of comments that really made it just a very partial victory and ultimately did not reflect well on the prosecution.
Okay. So that's brought us up to this morning. When we just found out that Judge McAfee has authorized an appeal of his decision. So sort of explain what's going on there and what the next steps are.
Right. So as soon as this decision came out from Judge McAfee, there was a sense that it would be very likely that this would be an order that the defendants would seek to appeal. Of course, in Trump's case, a big part of the strategy is to try to delay the trial beyond the November election. And so that is a part of it. But also, there was some language in this order that seemed like it could be pretty friendly to the defendants if they did seek an appeal. And so there was a sense that they would do that. And earlier this week, they did the first step in the Georgia procedure to seek an appeal of this type of order. What you have to do is seek a certificate of immediate review from the trial court judge. So this isn't something that's automatically appealable before trial. You have to go to the trial court judge and say, hey, we'd like to appeal. He then has to issue this certificate saying that you can appeal. And then within 10 days after that certificate being issued, there's the second step, which is going to the Georgia Court of Appeals and filing your application for appeal. Today, we learned that the defense has cleared that first hurdle. They've received a certificate of immediate review from Judge McAfee. However, the order, importantly, by Judge McAfee says that the trial court proceedings will not be stayed while they appeal. Of course, that could change based on what the Court of Appeals does. The Court of Appeals, after they file their application, has 45 days to decide whether to take up the appeal or to decline it. I think it's very likely that these defendants will ask the Court of Appeals to stay the proceedings below if they do decide to take it up. And it would be within the Court of Appeals' power to say to the trial court judge, I know you said that you aren't going to stay the proceedings, but we're directing you to do so. And Judge McAfee would have to put everything on pause. But right now, the case continues. He said that he would continue to, you know, rule on a bunch of pending motions. We can still have a lot of outstanding pending motions in this case. So it sounds like McAfee is going to continue to work through those. And the case continues while this appeal goes up to the Court of Appeals. And they will have to decide whether to take it up. If they do, it probably could be months before we hear anything from the Court of Appeals as to, you know, what they actually will do. Although they could always expedite the appeal and go more quickly than they usually do.
Anna, I just had a quick follow-up about the forensic misconduct question. You mentioned that there are only a few descriptions existing in Georgia law. Are there any clear lines here? So in other words, had Fani Willis said X in this speech, that would have clearly constituted forensic misconduct. What are the boundaries here?
Yeah, so I think that one thing that if she would have said, you know, the defendants filed this motion and it alleges XYZ, but they are just racist and they are guilty. And, you know, that is the kind of thing that would almost certainly be something that would be disqualifying because, you know, the church that she was in, that setting, it was one in which like a lot, it's a very well known historically Black church in Atlanta. The people who go there very well and who watch the services online, like the thousands of people very well could be people who are selected to be on that jury. And the idea around forensic misconduct is that you can't as a district attorney be going out and saying to the jury pool in public, these people are guilty, and just really kind of, you know, impugning their character by making these extrajudicial statements outside the context of the case itself. So, yeah, that'd be something that would be pretty clearly disqualifying under Georgia law.
I have to say, at the beginning of all this, I think there was, let's say, an instinct among commentators, maybe specifically among those who do not practice law in Fulton County, to cut Fani Willis some slack on this one and say, you know, it's a smear, right? I will say that Andrew Fleischman, who is a defense lawyer in Fulton County, who has come on the Lawfare podcast previously, was critical from the start. So points to him. But it does seem to me that like just the longer this has gone on, the worse the DA's office looks. Like I think I have no problem with McAfee's ruling. The sort of not outright disqualifying makes sense to me under the standard, but it just looks really, really bad. Like, is there anything, any redeeming story to be told here about the DA's office, or is this just like, wow, they really screwed up?
I agree with you, Quinta. I think that a lot of this looks really bad at the most basic level. And I think that this is a backstory a lot of folks maybe won't know or really kind of grasp, is that Fani Willis came into office in 2020. She was elected in 2020, and then, you know, started her position in 2021. But the person, her predecessor, Paul Howard, is a man whose tenure in office was plagued by scandal because of his conduct in which he was accused of sexually harassing employees. Clearly, this was a consensual relationship that Fani Willis and Nathan Wade had, so it's very different. But, you know, Fani Willis came into her position saying things like, you know, I will never be like Paul Howard and, you know, have a relationship with a subordinate. And at the very least, you know, Nathan Wade was her subordinate. Yes, he was a man who has, you know, his own success and his own qualifications. They are peers and colleagues, but you cannot, you know, deny the fact that there is something ethically, you know, questionable about the fact that she was engaged in a relationship with someone who was a subordinate and was not disclosed to any of the, you know, relevant, you know, human resources people or something like that. So I think that there is that at its most basic level, something that is really just does not look good. And then as the kind of evidentiary hearing and all of that went on, things really did not continue to get any better for the DA's office. That said, I do think that, you know, putting aside all of that, this case has been one that, other than this, the DA's office and maybe some other, you know, questionable public statements that Fani Willis was making, because you really are, as a prosecutor, you don't like to see prosecutors going out and making public statements about the case that they're prosecuting. It's usually just not a good idea. And there were other instances even before this in which Fani Willis, you know, maybe didn't have the same type of restraint that other prosecutors at the federal level, for example, have. But then again, she is an elected official. So she has some different considerations at play. But, you know, regardless, they had handled this case pretty well. You know, they had a lot of wins for months and months. And so I think that, I guess, maybe is something that is redeeming, is the kind of history of handling the case pretty well for a long time. But this, I do think, is something that was really questionable. So I think that's right. But I'd be interested to hear what other folks think, Tyler and Alan.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to paint with a broad brush with respect to sort of local and state and local prosecutors versus federal prosecutors. But I will say this does not give me a lot of confidence in the idea that, you know, we want federal officials, especially high-level ones, especially the president, necessarily prosecuted by state and local prosecutors, right? It just feels like the elected nature of those offices, the potential wide variance in quality, it just makes me, you know, I gotta say, I've always been somewhat skeptical of the idea that you want to expose presidents to state and local prosecution for a lot of these reasons. And this performance has definitely made that skepticism even more skeptical.
Yeah. And I kind of wonder to what extent some of this could have been the public kind of perception of all of this would have been different with a different communication strategy by the DA's office. You know, there was a lot of communications PR failings here, I think. Like, after Ashley Merchant filed that motion, Fannie Willis went out and did the church speech where she didn't really address the allegations, but kind of did. And then like a month went by before the state filed its response. There was just like a really kind of lack of, you know, that vacuum really allowed people to kind of fill the space with a lot of assumptions and allegations and whatnot. And then, you know, even as recently as after Nathan Wade resigned, I don't know if you guys saw this, but Nathan Wade was supposed to do Meet the Press after he resigned.
That was poorly thought
out. Canceled yeah. for a family emergency.
I mean, it, and so it's just things like that where you are kind of like, what, you know, this is not great judgment in terms of just the PR aspect of it all. And, you know, the Trump team and Roman's team and everyone else has taken advantage of that.
And it's hard to blame them, honestly. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I think, you know, with Trump's 87 different legal issues, we've seen so much bad lawyering. We've seen so much bad faith, you know, nonsense lawyering. But I think I got to say, when it comes to this one, it, you know, it's hard to blame them for dragging the DA through the coals on this one.
No, I think that, you know, it's very interesting to me that I actually think that the most effective defense strategy that Trump has had in any of his cases has been his Fulton County team. They have managed to somehow avoid making some of the more ridiculous statements and briefs that his federal teams and his New York team has filed in those cases. And, you know, Steve Sadow is a really well-respected attorney in the Atlanta area. He's done, I think that he's done what any good defense attorney would do in this case, which is kind of seize the moment. And, you know, it's really unfortunate that the strategy has, you know, distracted from the alleged crimes here that are very serious, and especially in the lead up to the 2024 election, is something that we should be paying attention to. But you kind of can't blame them because, you know, the district attorney's office is at fault here in some sense.
Well, as you pointed out, this saga is amazingly not over yet, depending on how these appeals go. And so we will have you back to talk about it. But for now, we will let you go, continue your gallivanting around the country covering these cases. Thanks, Anna, for stopping by.
Thanks. Wait, I have one question. It's for Tyler. Did I earn my matzo ball soup?
I think you earned not only one, but two helpings of matzo ball soup.
Yes. Amazing. Great. Well, thanks, guys, for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, in keeping with weird stuff coming out of the South, we are going to journey westward to the Western District of Louisiana. Back in May 2022, in a case that was originally filed as Missouri v. Biden, the attorneys general of Missouri and Louisiana, along with private plaintiffs, alleged in district court that federal officials coerced social media companies into removing certain content or demoting it in people's feeds on topics ranging from COVID-19 to election security, among other many other topics that we can get into. Fast forward to July 4th of last year, when the district judge ruled in favor of the plaintiffs, issuing a preliminary injunction, which essentially prohibited government officials from communicating with social media companies, as they had been alleged to do. Fast forward once more to October of last year, when the Supreme Court agreed to hear the case, now known as Murthy v. Missouri. And fast forward even more to Monday of this week, March 18th, when we heard, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in the case. There's a lot of interesting issues here. I think the primary one being this sort of line between persuasion and coercion on the side of the government in terms of influencing essentially speech on social media platforms. And I want to get into that. But first, Quinta, I'm curious. I know that you listened in on oral argument on Monday. Could you give us a bit of a play-by-play or your impressions of how the justices viewed the case and how they might rule?
So as you say, important context here is that this case it's weird, is the most polite thing I could say. The most honest thing I could say would be that it's completely lunatic. And what I mean by that is that the fact pattern here is just weird as hell and kind of made up. So there was a point in oral argument where Justice Sotomayor said to counsel for Louisiana, Benjamin Aguinaga, counselor, I have such a problem with your brief, and then proceeded to say, you know, it attributes things that happen to other people, to particular people, it confuses all kinds of statements, et cetera, et cetera. And Aguinaga seemed genuinely kind of chastened and, you know, sort of bent over himself to apologize. The issue here is that the district court, in this kind of incredibly long process down at that level of the court, reached conclusions in this injunction that it issued, which prevents sort of large swaths of the government from communicating with social media companies, that just massively distort what was actually happening, and sort of twists what was in some instances government outreach that arguably crossed the line, in some instances government outreach that genuinely was sort of the government working together with platforms to, you know, say, hey, there's, you know, something really bad going on here that you might want to know about, into a kind of vast left-wing conspiracy to censor conservatives, including, as Sotomayor was kind of pointing out, and as Justice Kagan also dug into a bit, instances where, you know, someone's post was taken down by Facebook months after there was a communication between the government and Facebook about a sort of semi-related issue, which the plaintiffs are now alleging is directly attributable to the government itself. So the facts are all over the place here. The Fifth Circuit sort of repeated some of that, cut down a little bit on the crazy. I should say that this injunction, which was narrowed by the Fifth Circuit, has been stayed by the Supreme Court while the justices are considering this case. I think that context is really important because what I'm going to say next kind of cuts against that, which is that the legal issues are genuinely unsettled here. And I do think that there are real First Amendment questions about to what extent you want the government to be able to kind of tap a platform on the shoulder and say, like, hey, there's material here that we're not super crazy about. Might you consider taking this down? Like, that is a genuine issue. And the doctrine on this is confusing. First Amendment doctrine is always a mess. I think this is particularly messy just because it hasn't been fleshed out particularly well. And so I was kind of cheered to see most of the justices really seeming to, you know, attempt to address this in good faith. Justice Alito, big surprise, seemed to be the only person who really bought what Louisiana was selling here. I think everyone else seemed both conscious of the distortions in the record and aware of the potential concerns of creating a standard that's so strict that it would make it impossible for the federal government to say, reach out to Facebook and say, you know, like, hey, there's terrorism came up a lot. You know, there's terrorist content, or, you know, there's a foreign influence operation happening on your platform. You might want to take a look at that, and so on and so forth. So I came away not having a great sense of what particularly the court will rule, but with a pretty strong sense that a majority of the justices seemed not impressed with Louisiana's argument. That's a different question than, you know, ideally in a perfect world, what kind of form would a doctrine that sort of holds the government back from being overly censorious, but still allows the flexibility that's needed, like what that would actually look like. I don't know. I think it's a genuinely tough problem. We'll see how the court comes out here, but I did not come out of this tearing my hair, as I sometimes do when I listen to oral arguments.
Are you saying this was no net choice argument, Quinta?
I mean, the thing is, in net choice, they were trying to.
They were just confused sort of, in a way that
yeah,
they didn't
confused.
Seem in this case.
Here, they were less confused, yeah.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Yeah, just to give a specific example of the muddiness of the record or the fact pattern, back in September, after Missouri v. Biden, after the district court ruled, Yoel Roth, who was the head of, I believe, site integrity for Twitter during the 2020 election, felt so compelled to set the record straight that he wrote a post for the Knight First Amendment Institute called Getting the Facts Straight, where in which he didn't weigh in on the legal issues at all, which is, I think, understandable given his background, but he wanted to set the record straight on a few things, one of which being that he pointed out that in the preliminary injunction in Missouri v. Biden, the injunction actually incorrectly asserted that Twitter had censored discussions of the so-called lab leak theory of COVID-19 in addition to Facebook, when he claims that Twitter did no such thing. It was only Facebook on that side, which I think also brings up important questions about job owning's effect on different social media platforms being able to set their own standards and act differently from one another, consumers having different choices in terms of platforms rather than platforms themselves being pressured to act in unison by the government. But that was just one specific example that seems pretty significant that I wanted to point out.
Yeah, let me hop in and just say that I basically agree with everything that Quinta said. You know, I do want to emphasize the point Quinta made that, like, there really are difficult issues here. And while a lot of the facts alleged appear to not have happened, which is awkward, I mean, that's bad lawyering. Yeah, you really don't want a justice basically accusing you of lying during oral arguments.
It was, like, genuinely striking how Aguinaga, like, really seemed shocked by the exchange.
Yeah, that's not so good. You know, at the same time, I really want to emphasize there were some bad things that the government did. You know, shortly after the district court judgment came out, I did a podcast with Jeff Kossoff and Derek Bambauer, where we sort of went through, and you know, I think we were all pretty skeptical of the extremely broad injunction, but we did recognize that there was some not great stuff the government did. I mean, you know, there was someone, I forget the exact title, social media something in the White House, who was basically sending profanity-laden screeds at social media companies.
Yeah, that guy was clearly not doing his job particularly well.
Well, I mean,
let's put it that way. Maybe,
well, except the problem, of course, is that he seemed to think that that was his job. I mean, that was the whole issue. I mean, and then there were some comments about, you know, Section 230, and maybe we have to revisit that, right? It's a little bit of a, that's an awfully nice Section 230 liability immunity you have there. It'd be a shame if anything happened to it. You know, again, I think Quint is right, and I think as the Supreme Court will rule, you know, when you look at it in the totality, those isolated incidents, while bad, and hopefully the Supreme Court does the Supreme Court opinion does a drive-by chastisement of the government with respect to those, they don't rise to the level of anything that would justify the sort of broad-based injunction. But you know, it is a legitimate problem. And the other thing that I would say is, you know, I think it is tempting, both because it's kind of analytically cleaner and because, you know, right now the politics line up in the following way, that it's easier just to say, look, we should just have a really bright line rule that the government is allowed to communicate with private parties as long as there is not explicit coercion or really heavy-handed implicit coercion, right? And that's probably going to be sort of what the court rules, because it's kind of hard to figure out what else to say. But to be clear, that's not actually the standard in all domains of law. And it's not also the standard that, you know, progressives necessarily should want. So Eugene Volokh, who's a law professor at UCLA, wrote a really interesting piece on the Volokh conspiracy, just pointing out that when it comes to, for example, the Fourth Amendment and what we think of state action under the Fourth Amendment, obviously not related to this case, but similar conceptual question, the courts often are willing to find state action when the police induce or even honestly just ask a private entity to engage in an action that, were it done by the police, would potentially violate the Fourth Amendment. Now, again, that's not to say that that should necessarily be the standard here. There are different considerations. But it is to point out that the theory of the case by the plaintiffs, that when the government asks social media companies to take down speech, that's concerning. That's not a crazy theory, right? And I think what's unfortunate in this case is that, you know, what started off as a legitimate concern that should have been really thought through and even potentially litigated became this kind of right-wing fever dream that by the time it got to the Supreme Court was just like so out over its skis that, you know, you have people like Justice Sotomayor correctly chastising the advocates for not being honest. And again, like that's bad. They should not do that. But I really don't want to lose track of the fact that, you know, it's very easy to imagine the politics of this being reversed and people on the center and the left being extremely upset that the government is going anywhere near social media companies and asking them to take content down.
Yeah, I mean, you're not wrong. And I think that is one of the difficulties.
High praise from Quint Adressa.
We're agreeing. We're on the same page on this one.
I need a certificate. You're not wrong. For suitable for framing.
I want that on a pillow.
Yeah, mark the time and date.
Oh my God.
No, I mean, I think it is one of the weirdnesses that we do have this kind of genuinely unsettled doctrine. There are real questions here, not only about like the law, but also, you know, how do we want to live in a society that have kind of been warped by this right-wing fever dream. And I think it's a good demonstration of how, you know, we're talking about the Fifth Circuit, because this came out of the Fifth Circuit. The Fifth Circuit, of course, also, we're recording this on Wednesday, has had a real banner, like 36 hours in terms of whether or not it was allowing SB4, this Texas criminal immigration enforcement law, to go into effect, where it was in effect and then it was not in effect and then it was in effect again. And you know, it's no way to run a railroad. And I do think that the sort of just like loony stuff that comes out of the Fifth Circuit, in all areas of law, we're focusing on First Amendment here, and you know, the net choice cases also involved a loony Fifth Circuit decision. It's just like, it's not good for the law. It's not good for how we think about these issues. It creates all kinds of weirdnesses and complications that make it difficult to kind of cut through to the actual problems at issue. The one thing that like slightly cheers me about this is that it seems like the Supreme Court is kind of losing its patience with this kind of behavior.
The Fifth Circuit is the new Ninth Circuit.
Yeah, I mean, kind of, yeah.
It's like on the other side, yeah.
They're
just like not what I would have expected.
Like, thrown out all kinds of crazy stuff, and the Supreme Court, including, you know, a lot of very conservative justices, are finding themselves having to be the adults in the room. And you could tell a story where this ends up, you know, the Fifth Circuit has a kind of road to Damascus moment and changes its approach. I kind of doubt that, frankly. But it is telling, I think, how frustrated the justices were, except for Alito, with the arguments that Louisiana was making, and that Louisiana was making in part because the district judge and the Fifth Circuit allowed them to take that kind of glide path without really challenging them and pushing them on a lot of the crazy assertions they were making.
Yeah, I think this is actually a really good example of Pyrrhic lower court victories. And you actually see this kind of all over the place. Or, I mean, to take a completely unrelated example from just the opposite side of the political spectrum, because this isn't a thing that can happen, right? You know, one reason I think that, for example, Harvard lost so badly in the affirmative action case before the Supreme Court is because there was a perception that the lower court in that case was doing a lot of sort of covering for Harvard in how it described the Harvard admissions scheme, which was great for Harvard in that moment. But then the problem is you have this kind of record that then goes up to the higher courts. And if the higher courts think that, like, it's really unconvincing, then you're really off on the wrong foot. And so, you know, this can happen on the left, it can happen on the right. And, you know, this, there may be a larger lesson here about the need for kind of more just judicial ideological diversity on all the circuit courts of appeals. You just kind of avoid extreme rulings either way.
I'm curious about putting the legal questions aside for a second and thinking about how this could actually work in process or sort of the policy angle. I think Matt Perrault, friend of the pod, friend of Lawfare, put the challenge really well when he said in another Knight First Amendment post that he said, quote, "The challenge is to develop solutions that mitigate job owning's most abusive forms while preserving the benefits of company government communication." Alan, I know you've thought about this a little bit, about the policy issues here. You know, I'd love to throw it back to you.
Yeah. And again, I don't pretend to have an answer here. I mean, this really does trade off very difficult considerations. So you're always going to piss off everyone, but you know, that's the space I like to be in. That's my comfort zone. As you all know, you know, I'm a big believer that this is one of these areas in which the cliche sunlight is the best disinfectant is actually not just a cliche. It's an important point and a meaningful one. I think a lot of the concerns around job owning is that it happens in secret. Right. It happens because someone in the White House or someone in the federal government calls somebody of theirs in the social media companies, and then something happens. And I do think that what we need to see more of is the government just making its case publicly as to what it thinks is false or really harmful, and calling on, if it wants to, social media companies to react accordingly. And then the social media companies can do so, or they cannot do so, right? And then we'll be able to have that debate. And you know, I think that you could make this a legal rule, right? I mean, you could make part of the job owning test for First Amendment purposes whether this was done covertly or overtly. But you could just have it as a policy matter, right? Because, you know, I think if the government's willing to say, look, we think such and such is wrong and bad, and we're willing to make the case to the American people, right? And we're not ordering anyone to do it. We're not threatening anyone to do it. But we just think that, like, you shouldn't have such and such content on your platform, and then the companies can respond or not. I think that's a fairer way, and it would avoid the perception of conspiracy, right? Now, again, look, you're never going to satisfy everyone. Conspiracy theorists are going to conspiracy theorize. But I'm not that interested in the lunatic, convincing the lunatic fringe of either side, right? I'm interested in giving some comfort to the people in the kind of broad middle, right, who are legitimately concerned with job owning, but at the same time realize that sometimes there's really bad false stuff out there, and the government might have a comparative advantage in spotting that. So, you know, that is my, again, I don't want to call it a solution, but I do think that reform would, over the long term, be valuable, and certainly would be better than these, like, off the record, who the heck knows what kind of collaboration or coordination is happening.
You know, I'm going to say something else you can put on a sampler. I want to agree with you. And what nice. I mean by that is that I don't know, like 5 years ago, I would have said, yes, sunlight's the best disinfectant, get it out there, have it in the open. I will say Matt and I recorded a great podcast with Alex Abdo at night, which I believe will be out on the same day that you're listening to this podcast, dear listener. So you can go and take a listen to that, where we discuss the possibility of kind of, you know, transparency procedures also for behind the scenes communication. And my worry with that kind of argument is just like, we have seen how little the facts matter to people who are making these conspiratorial arguments. And what I mean by that is that, you know, you have reams and reams and reams of evidence about, you know, COVID-19, vaccines, the fact that the 2020 election wasn't stolen, and it hasn't convinced anyone. It's actually, there's kind of a counterintuitive way where, like, the more data you have, the easier it becomes in some sense at a certain point to point at it and just kind of yell and wave your hands around and say, like, oh my God, there must be something, you know, hinky going here because, you know, here's my, you know, it's always sunny red conspiracy.
Because I've created
map.
A ton of smoke. There must be fire.
Exactly. And so I'm not saying that it wouldn't help. Like, I don't want to fall into the trap of saying this is a big problem and therefore small fixes are completely useless. But I do think, like, it is a small fix, if that makes sense. Well, speaking of the U.S. government's efforts to understand what to do with social media, Reuters had a pretty wild report that came out on March 14th about a covert influence operation authorized by the Trump administration against China. Out of course, the CIA, which, and I'll just quote here, the CIA created a small team of operatives who used bogus internet identities to spread negative narratives about Xi Jinping's government while leaking disparaging intelligence to overseas news outlets.
I want to know what cat turd is in Chinese, right? Like, I got to assume those were the... just like, so, over the so, handles right. and stuff.
I have a lot of questions about this. Among them are, like, how effective is it to have a social media influence operation in a country that famously has a great firewall and, like, takes things down very aggressively? Like, you can't even post pictures of Winnie the Pooh on Weibo because it gets taken down. Because there was a joke that Xi Jinping looked like Winnie the Pooh.
Oh, he does look a little.
I think it was like there's a picture of him next to Obama. And Obama was taking.
I guess so. He does look a little roly poly.
So look, I mean this thing, like, it's easy to make fun of. I am more than happy to make fun of it. But I am curious before we go into the mockery for what both of you make of this. I mean, Tyler, I'm interested in your take in part because you've recently been spending a lot of time thinking about U.S. foreign policy and sort of behind the scenes operations in different contexts. How did you read this story?
Yeah, I guess I didn't find it that shocking that it was happening. I don't want to appear to have a tinfoil hat on or anything, but I know any time that a report comes out that the CIA does X, I think any even
putting
cursory,
LSD in the drinking water.
I know, right? Any I think any like cursory understanding of the history of the CIA shouldn't surprise anyone that an influence operation like this is happening. I was surprised at how sort of low budget, not to go back into the mockery already, but how like low budget and unimpressive it was. This image of just a few, I don't know, spooks in a room trying to leak out information, probably in very heavy-handed or, you know, not very nuanced Mandarin. I don't know exactly what it looked like, but I guess I wasn't surprised in when this story came out. I have been reading Alexander Ward's great book, The Internationalists, about the first 2 years of the Biden administration's foreign policy making. So I was curious about you know, whether these types of activities have continued into the Biden administration. There are a lot of questions that have come up for me in reading the book so far about the continuity versus, you know, breaking with Trump's foreign policy, because the tagline of the book is restoring American foreign policy essentially after Trump. But there are quite a few continuities, especially when it comes to Biden's stance on China, wanting to appear just as tough, if not tougher on China than Trump. So those are the questions that came up for me, not so much, you know, whether why this was surprising that it happened at all.
Yeah, I mean, I should say, Alan, before I let you jump in. So as you say, Tyler, it's one of the things in the story. It says this took place in 2019. It does say it's not clear whether it has continued. I will note that in 2022, the Washington Post had a big story about a report by the organizations Graphica and the Stanford Internet Observatory that identified what seemed pretty clearly to be a attempted Pentagon covert influence operation in the Middle East, attempting to move people toward the United States, which was also astonishingly clumsy. And there is likewise no evidence that it was particularly effective one way or the other. That caused a bit of an uproar. And after the fact, the Pentagon said that I believe that they were shutting it down and that they were auditing how it conducts these kinds of operations. So at least as of recently, we have a strong indication that the Biden administration is not looking so kindly on this kind of thing, at least within the Pentagon. And I would say also, I mean, it's always fun to make fun of the CIA, but these kinds of like covert influence efforts are actually not something that, other than this 2022 Pentagon dust up, not something that there's a lot of evidence that the U.S. has been engaging in recently, which I would argue is a good thing because A, there's no evidence that they work, and B, it's just like torching your own credibility when you complain about influence operations from Russia. But Alan, what do you think?
No, I think that's all right. I mean, I because I'm like kind of a perverse devil's advocate, I want to justify this somehow.
We have to disagree about something.
It's hard to, right? I mean, this doesn't seem very well thought out. Doesn't seem very well done. Again, it's not clear that this would work. As you point out, Quinta, right? You're throwing rocks while standing in a very glass house, right? Given just how vulnerable our open society is to manipulation relative to others, we should be trying to set a norm here, right? Rather than, again, like you said, torch our credibility for uncertain gain. The thing that I do want to emphasize, though, is I want to say something in defense of the CIA here. China is an incredibly hard target, right? And this is something that we really don't appreciate. It is almost impossible to do human intelligence gathering in China because of how closed of a society it is, because of how much surveillance there is.
And because all the CIA's assets were rolled up in recent years.
CIA's assets were rolled up. The language barrier is not insignificant, frankly. You know, we've spent 2 decades teaching everyone, you know, in the intelligence community, you know, Pashto. And that was reasonable. That wasn't like a bad thing to do. But as someone who spent 2 years every morning at 9 a.m. in college trying to learn Chinese and did not learn Chinese, it is a very hard language to learn, right? So trying to, you know, train up people to do this is very difficult. You know, it's a very ethnically homogenous society, so it's hard to just take like a random, you know, non-Chinese person, teach them Chinese, and then send them to China, right? So then you are trying to recruit Chinese Americans, right? But that creates its own very complicated set of issues, right? And that community may not, you know, also prefer that for a variety of issues, variety of reasons. So, you know, I want to say in defense of the CIA that this is a very hard problem. We need to refocus on intelligence gathering in China. And, you know, if this was all right, we got to make China a priority for intelligence gathering and for, you know, covert operations. Let's throw stuff on the wall. Let's see what sticks. Again, I'm not trying to defend that approach, but it is somewhat understandable. And you know, I just don't want to lose sight of the fact that China, which is, I think, again, without question, the great strategic competitor and adversary for the next, you know, foreseeable future. As much as I worry about the Cold War framing that sometimes people say, I don't think it's entirely wrong, frankly. And so I hope the CIA continues to try to do intelligence collection in China. I don't have any suggestions for how they do it, but it is an important thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I would say is like there's an argument that conducting these kinds of offensive propaganda operations undermines your ability to actually collect useful information because it makes it easier for the Chinese government to, you know, paint people as American stooges and so distrust and so on and so forth, right? And there's also an argument that, you know, I think, Tyler, to your point earlier, like, there's just, so we haven't seen the stuff that the CIA produced. I will say the stuff that the Pentagon.
The products of the CIA meme lords.
Yeah.
Though I desperately want to.
Oh, yeah. Oh the God, stuff that the Pentagon so produced for the Middle East was, like, comically bad. I will also
was one of these
say,
complicated PowerPoints, like meme lording our way to victory.
Exactly right. Exactly. You know? There's an incredible article. This is my favorite use of FOIA ever from Vice in 2021, where in 2020, Cyber Command posted a meme on Twitter making fun of Russian intelligence operations as kind of like a election integrity thing. And it has like a guy wearing a bear costume because this is October, so Halloween.
No. It's clearly a bear, Quinta.
So, okay,
it's not
he's
a guy
bear.
Wearing a bear. It's a straight up bear.
He's like holding a pumpkin and he's tripped and the candy falling out of the pumpkin has like labels of Russian hacking efforts. And according to the FOIA records, it took Cybercom 22 days to develop, workshop, and produce this image.
And they how were much very reminds, proud. At a cost of so, what to the taxpayer?
Exactly.
So this reminds me of one of my favorite Brooklyn Nine-Nine episodes where Captain Holt gets sent to PR and has to spend months helping name the Met Pigeon mascot for the NYPD.
But it's also
like a real vibe there.
There are things that the government is good at. Intelligence collection is one of them. Making memes, not so much. Just like stick to your strengths, guys.
If there was ever an argument for privatization, right? It's like we should give. So no, here's my proposal. Elon Musk should be responsible for getting payloads into orbit and for creating dank memes. Because
no,
I feel like
his,
that
no,
is...
No, his posts, Alan, his posts are so bad. His posts are terrible.
I have to make a seize the memes of production joke in here somewhere.
That's good!
That is good. All right. Well, clearly, before we completely devolve into silliness, I think this is a good place to end it. But this would not be rational security if we did not end with some object lessons. So, Quinta, let's start with you. What's your object lesson?
I am sharing true crime courtroom drama with you all from the Detroit News, because it's always good to support local news. This is the tale of something that happened in federal court in D.C. the other day. Where a woman, her name is Stephanie Lambert. She is a Michigan lawyer. She is representing one Patrick Byrne, former CEO of Overstock and election conspiracy truther, against Dominion.
Wait, Overstock? Really?
Oh, yeah.
I love that site.
He resigned, so,
first
so
I,
you're good.
First,
you're,
I lose okay. the my, first I lose the MyPillow guy, then Overstock.
No, he left, leave he left the, leave company, the and alone. I think he had there's like some kind of fight with the board because...
Okay, so I can still... You're saying so I can still buy
you can
discount
still buy
furniture
your chairs.
From... Okay.
So he is being sued by Dominion for allegedly telling lies about the company over the 2020 election. This woman, Stephanie Lambert, was in federal court in D.C. as part of that litigation. And at the end of the hearing, the courtroom was cleared, the U.S. Marshals came in, and she was arrested on a bench warrant from a Michigan court because she had been charged and was evading the authorities in a separate case against her in Michigan state court for allegedly tampering with Michigan voting machines, also related to the 2020 election.
What a rock star.
This is incredible. I love it. She has since appeared in DC Superior Court and said that she was not trying to evade arrest. I believe she said it was a miscommunication.
Is
that a legal
said,
defense?
You're arrested. And she said, yes, I'd love to go to the Bahamas.
I love the idea that you have there's like a bench warrant out for your arrest and you show up in federal court. The whole thing is incredible. everything about this story is great. It's a great demonstration of how this sort of election conspiracy theory world is a closed universe, because Lambert is also involved in the Michigan Kraken lawsuit and makes some appearances in the effort to discipline the lawyers coming out of that litigation. So keep your eye on this one, folks. It's a great story.
It's also just not a very high-skilled bunch. Like, this is not the best and the brightest of the legal profession.
Quinta, I think I said this to you before, but I am once again calling for a complete and total shutdown of the legal profession until we can figure out what the hell is going on.
Honestly, we could use it.
You're good. You're spicy today, Tyler. I'm loving this. All right. Well, spicy Tyler, three chili pepper Tyler. What's your object lesson?
Well, as I am in DC, I was going to offer the beloved Stumpy cherry blossom tree as my object lesson. So I will still drop that in the notes. But mere minutes before we started recording, Quinta created a work of art graphic to demonstrate political advantage over time of delaying Trump's January 6th trial. So Quinta, if I could ask you just to paint a mental picture for the listener now.
Yes. Yeah, so this is I am an artist. Thank you.
We will put this on Twitter. Don't worry, everyone.
So it is a graph. On the x-axis is time, and there is a little mark for the election. On the y-axis is political advantage to Trump. And then there's a line that is marked benefit of delaying trial, which goes up and to the right steadily, except at a point just before the election where it suddenly dips way, way, way down.
It's like kind a of negative like a, asymptote to
exactly,
infinity.
Exactly. Yeah. It's kind of a black hole situation. And then it dips up and continues onward. And the black hole is labeled a black hole of awful. You could also call it the black hole of political disadvantage. The argument being that, of course, it is super great for Trump to delay his trial, but at a certain point, you will delay it until the end of the summer, but not enough. So it goes to trial right in the thick of campaign season, and then maybe you get convicted on like October 31st.
What is that? That would be a great October surprise.
Yep.
All right. For my object lesson, my wife and I are really enjoying a Netflix kind of limited series called The Gentlemen. It's kind of a remake of a Guy Ritchie film from a few years ago. And Guy Ritchie also made this. The premise is basically a British aristocrat ends up getting mixed up with drug dealers who are using his estate to grow a bunch of marijuana, and Guy Ritchie hijinks ensue. I will say, I find Guy Ritchie movies reasonably entertaining. I don't love them, and so I didn't have super high hopes for this, but for some reason, if you take a Guy Ritchie movie and you stretch it out to 8 hours, it's actually great because everything goes slower. Like, it's not as compressed as your Guy Ritchie movie is. And I think Guy Ritchie is actually much better, maybe, in longer form content.
More cool fight scenes?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's about the thing is, it's the same number of cool fight scenes that you have in a Guy Ritchie movie, except it's stretched out. And so, like, he allows the kind of story to breathe a little bit. And he's actually pretty funny. He's a stylish director. The cinematography is done pretty well. So I gotta say, I'm really enjoying it. You know, I haven't finished it. So you never know what happens in the last two episodes. So if it all goes terribly wrong, my apologies. But yeah, that's my object lesson, the Gentleman on Netflix. Thank you, Guy Ritchie. Well, that brings us to the end of this week's episode. Rational Security is, of course, a production of Lawfare. So be sure to visit lawfaremedia.org for our show page with links and past episodes, for our written work and the written work of other Lawfare contributors, and for information on Lawfare's other podcast series, including The Aftermath. And be sure to follow us on Twitter or X at, X the way that Scott does.
I don't know if it had quite his je ne sais quoi.
He's better
at
the nine.
Close.
Thank you. Well, be sure to follow us at RATL Security and be sure to leave a rating or review wherever you might be listening. Also, sign up to become a material supporter of Lawfare on Patreon for an ad-free version of this podcast and other special benefits. Our audio engineer and producer this week was Noam Osmond of Goat Rodeo, and our music, as always, was performed by Sophia Yan. We are once again edited by the wonderful Jen Patya. On behalf of my co-host Quinta and our special guests Tyler McBrien and Anna Bauer, I am Alan Rosenstein, and we will talk to you next week. Until then, goodbye.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.